Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, December the 14th, and it's time for The Week in Review. Every Friday at this time, we talk with two guests from different perspectives about the news of the week, and we invite your participation, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. We invite you to bring up a topic from the news this week and present it to our guests to discuss, maybe debate. Our two guests today, Peg Lautenschlager, is a former Democratic Attorney General of Wisconsin, also a former state legislator, former U.S. attorney. She's currently a lawyer with the law firm Lawton and Cates in Madison. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
And Jim Miller also joins us. He is president of the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Joy.
And let's start with the story that broke yesterday afternoon. Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig calls the Mitchell Report a call to action. He says he will act. The report by former Senator George Mitchell links 85 players to illegal use of steroids and other performance-enhancing drugs. Among those accused are 7 MVPs and 31 All-Stars. Congress right away wants to hear more about this and has asked Bud Selig, Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig, Union Leader Donald Fair, to testify at a House committee hearing next week. What do we make of this, Peg Lautenschlager?
Well, I don't know. You know, it's interesting, but I think from a cultural standpoint, it's a sad commentary on the emphasis we placed on sports, the kinds of demands we have on the game and the like. I was part of a conversation with a bunch of fellows at a breakfast in Fond du Lac the other morning, a Saturday morning get-together, mostly labor union guys, mostly of my political perspective. And as much as they were complaining about player salaries and the like, the other complaint was whether or not you could get NFL Game Day or the Baseball Extra Innings Channel or the Big Ten Channel on whatever cable or satellite dish service you had. So, you know, I think we've got a situation where Americans want it both ways. They want their athletes to be superheroes. They want to have that sort of level of competition going on, and yet at the same time, they think they're going to get it in some other way. So, you know, I don't know. I think at some point we have to look at all sports, whether it's Olympic athletes, whether it's baseball, whatever it happens to be, amateur or professional, and say, hey, let's get real and let's figure out ways in which these sports are adequately controlled.
Jim Miller?
Oh, first of all, most sports do this. I mean, certainly at the Olympics, cycling have major drug testing. We just haven't really implemented that, especially in baseball. I don't think anybody's really surprised that Barry Bonds has been using steroids. I just think that what Mitchell did yesterday was confirmed what a lot of people have known for a long time. There's been long-term cheating in baseball. And Mitchell made a good point, I thought, yesterday when he was saying some of the victims of this are the guys who play by the rules. Obviously, baseball has a major problem. There's going to be enormous confidence in what's gone on over the years. And baseball, unlike other sports, records count because it's a cultural game. And I think I would agree with Peg on some of that. The records obviously have been tainted. You know, you have the best pitcher of our time and the best home run hitter of our time. They have clearly cheated. Now, they're going to say, well, we didn't, and these, you know, can you prove it? Well, there's two points of proof here. There's a legal proof, and then there is the public relations proof. I think most people will take what Mitchell said, treat it as gospel, and believe the people named in that cheated. And I think baseball's got one serious PR problem.
Yeah, well, we also have a Florida Republican Cliff Stearns, a U.S. representative who had sponsored a bill and held hearings on this issue back in 2005, called on Bud Selig to resign. Certainly a lack of leadership and oversight in Major League Baseball enabled these abuses to continue. Stearns said, after 15 years of slow action, a new commissioner is needed to guide the league out of this era of drug abuse. Bud Selig, of course, was a former owner of the Milwaukee Brewers.
That's right. And, you know, and it gets to the kind of wanting it both ways. I mean, the owners want these superheroes, these super athletes, these guys who can perform like Barry Bonds. And they want the profits that come with that, and they want to be able to build teams where they can pay players these extraordinary amounts of money. I think it's tragic, and I think it's real tragedy. And Jim and I are probably in the heat of agreement on this one today. But it's that there's so many kids who grow up with baseball as part of your culture. I know in my family it was not just with our four boys, all of whom played Little League, but also with our daughter. And our, you know, annual trip as a family to Miller Park now, which I'm still missing County Stadium, I hate to say. No. But, it's still, something that matters. And it's something where you talk about it at holiday gatherings, even though the kids are now older. And it's sad to see a stain like this on the game.
Jim Miller, should Bud Selig resign over this?
I'm not so sure, but I mean, you know, what about the players' union? I mean, the players' union has basically been uncooperative on this issue from day one.
Oh, but the owners have been complicit in it too. They've done nothing.
I'm not saying they're not, but I mean, the players' union represents the players, and they basically have, you know, they have not allowed anyone to talk to Mitchell. Mitchell had no subpoena powers. Mitchell had to basically go with whatever he could find. I mean, it seems to me that what Mitchell is saying, and I tend to certainly agree with him, this is the tip of the iceberg. I mean, we have no idea how much illegal drugs are being used in baseball.
Let's keep everybody culpable, though. Replacing Selig would be very good,
depending on where you want to go with this. But I don't know that that's the problem. I mean, the problem is, what do you do about the players' union?
Well, but keep everybody culpable here. What do you do about the owners? What do you do about owners that refuse to disclose what the salaries are of administrators and how much money is going to the team versus how much money is going to administrators? I mean, everybody's in this together.
Yeah, let me bring in one caller on this, and then we'll move on to some other topics. Mary in Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to say, regardless of you know, the drug abuse, what have you, this is an issue that I hope Congress doesn't waste a lot of time on, because I think there's a lot more important things that we need to be dealing with. Sports fanaticism and that kind of thing is fanaticism of any kind is not good, but I just hope that Congress doesn't. For me, to me, it's a waste of time for them to be dabbling in what our sports heroes are doing or not doing. I'd rather have them dealing with issues that really affect everybody's lives, like education and the war in Iraq.
Mary, I agree with you in large part. I also think, though, that whether or not it's baseball or the arts, I've listened to members of Congress say, why are we doing this? Why are we funding the arts, for example? And I think that's an important part of our culture. And as a result, there may be a role for government to play in looking at some things. I agree that Congress shouldn't be wasting a lot of its time doing that. If laws were violated, prosecutors ought to be doing that. But baseball's an entity which is treated specially under the laws in terms of antitrust laws and a variety of things, and it's Congress that's allowed it to do that. And as a result, I think that, we should, things like the S-chip stuff going on and another veto of that and whatever, certainly are priorities of mine that are far greater than baseball. I do think that just letting the marketplace take care of the baseball issue isn't the way to go either.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jim Miller?
Well, this Congress doesn't do much, so maybe looking at baseball might be a good idea. But I think it's a lot more serious than is being said here. We're not talking necessarily about baseball players per se. We know they're bad. It's the impact they have on younger kids. I mean, you know, kids in high school look at these guys, and all of a sudden they see them doing well, and they know that they're cheating, but they're going to get better. It has an enormous impact on children across the country. Yeah. That's one of the real problems with this.
Yes. Well,
whether we like it or not, sports figures in this country are role models. We have a guy in Green Bay, I believe his number is number 4. You don't think he's a role model in this state? People look up to athletes, and they follow their leads. And it's real important to send a message to children in this country that cheating doesn't do you any good and we're not tolerating it anymore.
Well, I don't disagree with that at all. We should also, though, say that the people who own the teams are partially accountable, too, because the reality is then we're sending a message to kids that say, but if you're in charge, you can get out of jail free.
Oh, I have no problem with that.
Okay.
I mean, it's right across the line. But, I mean, to say that it's not a big issue, I think culturally this is a huge issue.
Yeah. Let's take a short pause and then talk about some other issues that Congress is dealing with. I think they did a thing or two besides talk about the sports and steroids issue, and we'll talk about that after this short pause with Jim Miller, president of the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute, and Peg Lautenschlager, former Democratic Attorney General of Wisconsin, currently an attorney with the law firm Lawton & Cates. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 21 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Friday, December the 14th. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins between 4 and 6. After 4, it's Your Views on the News, where you can call in and talk about your favorite news story of the week. And after 5, your nominations for Person of the Year. Time Magazine announces its Person of the Year next week. Who do you think it should be? That's this afternoon, Ben Marins, between 4 and 6. We're talking with two guests about the news of the week and welcoming your participation at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Talking with Jim Miller and Peg Lautenschlager. And one other thing that Congress did this week, the House approved an intelligence bill that would prohibit the CIA from using waterboarding and other harsh interrogation methods. The Senate still must act. The White House has threatened a veto. This all comes amid the recently revealed news that the CIA waterboarded some Al-Qaeda suspects in 2002 and then destroyed the videotapes of those investigations or those interrogations. Congress had the CIA chief before it this week testifying over this. Jim Miller, is this a big deal?
Yeah, sure, it's a big deal. I think, you know, waterboarding is an issue. I got two minds on this. The first one is, if you have a serious Al-Qaeda operative who you know has planned and killed Americans and is planning a big activity in the future, how do you treat them? On the other hand, there's only one person in Congress I would listen to about waterboarding. His name is John McCain. We know what he went through for 5 years in a North Vietnam prison. He says waterboarding makes no sense. I'm with John McCain.
Peg Lautenschlager?
Well, I'm with John McCain on the waterboarding making no sense, but I think the other underlying issue on this whole piece of action by the House is the notion of the CIA destroying the tapes. I think that there has been a disregard at all levels of government for those people who are filling roles in government's responsibility to the public. The notion you can pick or choose what information you share with the public when this is a democracy and we're supposed to have accountability of the government to its people is something that I think we've seen throughout this administration. Frankly, we saw it to some degree in the Clinton administration, and we're seeing it at the state level. We're seeing it in local units of government. And the notion that somehow government can be more effective if it operates kind of behind closed doors on occasion and outside the public purview, and that there's no obligation to keep and preserve records for public review is kind of a frightening concept, I think.
Yeah. Let me go to the phones. Jean in Madison, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, this question is specifically for Peg, but I'd certainly be interested in all comments from everyone. Is H.R. 1955, which passed about 6 weeks ago, now is Senate Bill 1959, Violent Radicalization of Homegrown Terrorism. It basically potentially suppresses freedom of speech on the Internet, and it certainly might appear to make thought of a violence illegal, or could make it illegal. I am curious as to what your views would be, given you were once an attorney general or of our state, and why do you think there's been little or no mention in the mainstream media.
You know, I don't know why there hasn't been a lot of mention in the mainstream media. I was just watching something about, you know, the pass given Bush on whether or not there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and there was a public television piece on that recently, which kind of talks about how the mainstream media kind of moves as a herd. But it was interesting to me that, you know, there's always should be tension in government, in my mind, between people who, you know, believe that you should be able to have access to certain records, access to certain data and the like, and then kind of the pushback tension. And to me, that's how democracy ought to work, whether or not it's liberals and conservatives, Democrats or Republicans, prosecutors or defense attorneys or whatever. There seems to be this necessary balance that should exist where you have, you know, a push in one direction and then a push back from the other. And we saw during the 80s and 90s an increasing desire on the part of law enforcement, particularly the FBI, and to a great extent when Louis Freeh was the head of the agency, to try to be able to access records, to try to be able to use intent as a crime in and of itself, the attempt, you know, looking at attempt crimes more seriously and the like. And there was always a pushback. Even in those days, there was a pushback from Janet Reno and others. Now what we're seeing is that there's no pushback. And I think that's a little frightening, because somehow in the post 9/11 world, the pushback has become un-American or pro-terrorist or something like that.
Yeah. Do you have anything on this, Jim?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I just would agree with Peg on, 9/11 changed all this. I mean, you know, this isn't the 80s and the 90s. There really are people out there around the world, and unfortunately probably in this country, who would like to kill Americans. And I think you got to basically have some government institutions who are doing what they have to do to not have that happen. Catching people after a terrorist attack is nowhere as important as stopping the terrorist attack from happening. And I think, you know, sure, people have rights in this country, there's no question. But this whole question of terrorism, it's not like something we've ever seen before.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, it can't be attacked the way we attacked certain rights in the 80s and 90s. It's got to be basically for the common good of the country.
Yeah, let me go back to... I'm sorry, hold on, Peg.
Go
ahead.
I mean, it sounds, Jim, as though you're almost saying that these terrorists suddenly appeared, that there was no anti-American thought, that there was no anti-American activity before that. I mean, we had domestic terrorism before that. We had international terrorism, never to the magnitude of an incident like 9/11, but, you know, we had the Oklahoma City bombing, which was internal and the like, and I think then the big question
becomes... That was like more of an individual act of a crazy person, as opposed to an institutional act.
No,
I
would argue against that. I mean, the shooting in Kansas City, I think, was different, but in Topeka, excuse me. But that was part of right wing. What would you call them? I mean, they're the, you know, the Third Continental Congress people. It's the old posse comitatus. I mean, Oxfam was part of that, and it was part of a system that's in place. We had people seeking refuge from federal gun charges. They had up in Mondavi, Wisconsin, of all places, in the 90s. I mean, we've dealt with these things before. I think, though, that...
I'm sorry. We haven't dealt with this before. We're talking about internationally, where they're attacking Americans, not only here but all over the world.
I mean, they've been attacking. Look at the Israeli people in the 1980 or 1972
Two.
Olympics. I mean, we've had this for a while. I mean, it's not.
No, we haven't
been
had
aimed
it.
At
the
all.
Israelis have had it.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, it's going on, and we know that.
Israelis are a lot more serious about defending themselves, and we probably
you know
are.
What, and you're right, and you know what, I've been to Israel, and I've gone through all of the you know, the checkpoints and the this and the that, and you know what, and they still have terrorists blowing up folks in coffee shops in Jerusalem.
And how many do you think more they would have if they didn't do what you just
said? At some point, it may run its course.
Let me bring us back to some of the news items from this week in particular, and that being late yesterday afternoon on the fresh off the presidential campaign trail here. a top advisor to Hillary Rodham Clinton's campaign, said he regrets making comments about Barack Obama's admitted drug use as a teenager. And in fact, Bill Shaheen has resigned his post as national co-chair of Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign for making those remarks. He had apparently said Republicans could dredge up Obama's past if Obama were the nominee, the Democratic nominee. What do you make of this, Peg Lautenschlager?
Oh, I think it's tragic that they would bring it up. I mean, I have a hard time believing that that somebody didn't think this was an effective way to get it out on the table. They probably tried other ways to get this into the dialogue before, and this is the way to do it. I get very disturbed when I hear somebody of either party sort of doing the electability argument, saying, oh, no, I'd better bring this up now because if not, the other guys will. I hate to do it. I find that insincere. I find it lousy politics. And you know, there are important issues we ought to be talking about in this presidential race. I mean, if I were Hillary Clinton, I would be talking about Barack Obama's experience or alleged lack thereof. If I were Barack Obama, I'd be talking about whether or not Hillary Clinton isn't so invested in the system that she can't make change. You know, I think I'd be talking about the Bush administration and the legacy it leaves and why they'd want to change. You'd talk about what why the Republican candidates just don't rise to the fore when it comes to things. And to be listening to this kind of debate, I think, is sad. I wish we could get beyond that kind of discussion in American politics and focus on significant issues.
Yeah. You suspect, though, Peg, that the Clinton campaign maybe did know about this, rather than saying that they didn't, you know, they didn't really have anything to say, Bill Shaheen's opinion, not Hillary Clinton's
opinion. Well,
you know,
Shaheen's, you know, I don't think of somebody of his caliber and of his experience let something like that slip in an interview that important.
Yeah, what do you think, Jim Miller?
Well, sometimes when I listen to the Clintons, it reminds me of Sergeant Schultz and Hogan's Heroes.
I know nothing.
I see nothing. The Shaheens have been involved with the Clintons going back to New Hampshire in 92 when Clinton came back to win that primary. I agree with Peg. I mean, people at that level, they don't make these kinds of mistakes. Strangely enough, I would disagree with Peg. I mean, you may not like it, but these kinds of issues are in our political structure. If I'm not mistaken, back in 2000, about a week or two before that presidential election, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there was a DUI charge made against George Bush. That had an impact in that election. I mean, these kinds of issues are going to get dredged up. Obama has not been vetted. Whether you like it or not, this stuff will be used. And certainly if the Republicans didn't know about that issue before, they do now.
Well, you know what, though? It was in his book. I mean, let's start with that. I mean, I'm the last person to talk about DUI issues. Let's get that out on the table. But I mean, the thing is
that... was not brought up anything to do with you. I'm just saying it happened to Bush out of nowhere in 2000.
All I'm saying, though, is that if what we are going to do as an American people is focus on what somebody did when he or she was 12 years old or 16 years old or whatever, and how far do we take that? You know, I think we could have made similar arguments years ago in the media on all of our elected officials. So, you know, whether it was, you know, Franklin Roosevelt or somebody as a, you know, personally conservative as a Woodrow Wilson, there's probably a skeleton in everybody's closet. And I think that this has become the focus of the fact that these sorts of things have become the focus of these 30-second ad campaigns. And
yeah, but I mean, there's something else going on.
Is sad.
I think there's something else going on, though, and it's just not Obama. It could also be someone like Mike Huckabee. We don't really know a lot about these kinds of candidates because they've never been vetted in the media before.
Let's look at his record as a state senator.
You will not know everything about these guys until well after the nominations are decided, because the media will be looking. But there's so many other stories, and there's so many candidates running, you can't possibly know everything about anybody.
I guess I just think, though, that in part it's laziness on the part of the American people and the media. It's a lot easier to run a splash story on, you know, headline news about somebody's drug use than it is to look into whether or not he or she voted in certain ways in a state legislative body. You know, I mean, I will always remember a moment I had with an editor, a new editor from a Madison newspaper here, and we were discussing pharmaceutical pricing cases. And right now, 30-some states in the nation have large cases involving allegations of mispricing and false pricing by pharmaceutical companies, and Wisconsin was one of the first states to do this. And as I went to an editorial board to explain all of this, the new editor, publisher, whatever, of this Madison paper, one of the biggest newspapers in the state, said, well, if Joe Lunchbucket can't understand this in three sentences, it's not our worth it's not worth our covering it.
Yeah,
well. You know, that's a tragedy. And but that's the nature of the game these days, and somebody would rather talk about someone's childhood drug use because it's easier to do. And I think we as an American public need to demand that the vetting involve issues of substance.
Yeah, well, let's talk about maybe not another issue of substance, but Mike Huckabee apologized to Mitt Romney yesterday for remarks he made to a reporter regarding Romney's religion, saying something along the lines, Huckabee saying something along the lines that he doesn't know a lot about the Mormon religion, but don't they believe that Jesus and Satan are brothers? And so anyway, he apologized to Mitt Romney. What do you make?
Actually, Joy, what he said was like, I was just asking a question.
Yeah.
Oh, that isn't an apology in this day and age?
Well, I don't think so.
Yeah. I thought he apologized, actually, so that I take that back.
Well, no, he may have, but I mean, I think he said it was a valid question. He wasn't making a comment.
Well, what do we make of Mike Huckabee soaring in the polls and the role of faith in, especially on the GOP side of the ticket, Jim Miller? We have Mitt Romney making his speech and Huckabee rising in the polls, and talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, candidly, I've been around these elections for an awful long time. We have a history in this country, first of all, of not particularly electing front runners in presidential campaigns. We also have a history of not electing sitting senators. I think we've only elected two sitting senators in United States history. We like governors. On the Republican end, very conservative evangelicals count in primaries just the way very, very liberal people count on the Democratic side. Our presidential politics in some states is dominated ideologically. Iowa is certainly a case in point. Evangelicals, the person that they have decided on in many instances, certainly in Iowa, is Mike Huckabee. That's who they're confident in. He's a good retail politician. That really works in a place like Iowa. If you listen to him compared to the other Republican candidates, he's quick on his feet. He's a good politician. I think he's rising, and one of the reasons is the other guys are going nowhere. I don't think any of the other Republicans who have been out there for a while as a front runner have made the sale. And, you know, in a funny way, I would suspect that you will know the Democratic nominee probably by the end of January. Republican nominee might not be until March or April.
And I saw something on the news that I wanted to ask you about, Jim Miller, that some people are hoping or speculating that maybe John McCain won't run as a Republican but as an independent with Mike Bloomberg on his ticket. What do you think of that?
Well, we have some polls coming out over the weekend in Wisconsin, and some of the numbers are stunning. I mean, I think 2008 could be much tougher than 92. People in this state and around the country are now saying that they're independents, some of the highest numbers we've ever seen in the country. I think there's a very real shot that someone like Mike Bloomberg could get into this before it's over. And I think he could be a major factor in the presidential race in 2008.
And how that how that impacts the race is going to depend on who he can convince to run with him. I mean, you have the
depending
you know.
On who the Republican and the. If you go back to 1992, when Ross Perot decided to run, Ross Perot was a successful businessman who said he was going to spend a lot of money. Reality is, he didn't. He spent some money to get on the ballot, but then he sort of fell apart. In early April of 92, he was in the 40s in a three-way race with Bush and Clinton. He ended up with 19% nationally and about 19% here. Bloomberg is not only a successful mayor of about the 11th largest government entity in the country, he's also been a successful businessman, and he could easily spend $1 billion. We've never seen anything like Bloomberg before in this country.
Well, and the other thing is,
I wouldn't necessarily think he's a spoiler. If he gets in the right situation, he may actually have a shot.
And also, Bloomberg doesn't have that kind of Ross Perot goofiness. You know, I mean, Perot is sort of almost a comical character
the
in some ways.
That's right.
Yeah, and whereas
Bloomberg's
a serious
guy.
Yeah, no, he's a solid guy. And I also think that if he gets in and peaks early and then drops in the way Perot maybe did, I think it's way too early to predict how that impacts the two major candidates, the party candidates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, you know, the one thing about Bloomberg is the money.
Yeah.
He's got
$20 billion?
I mean, he's worth about $16 billion, but I've heard estimates that he's willing to go at least $1
billion. Yeah, well, that's what they've been
saying. That would be more money
publicly than
either the Democrat or the Republicans spent together.
Right. Yeah, and they've said that publicly, but I guess what I'm saying is if you're worth $16 billion, it seems to me like as long as you have one or two left in the end, you're okay.
Yes.
I don't know how you could even spend that much money.
I think Peg and I are probably agreeing on this, that 2008 may be different than anybody thinks before it gets over.
Yeah, and you know, and I think it's interesting because I think on the Republican side, you know, the one thing we haven't talked about is that I think if the candidates, as different as they are really causing the Republican Party to have this internal struggle as to whether or not it's the social issue conservatives or if it's the, I mean, there's always been a bit of that, the economic conservatives or whomever who are going to sort of take the lead in the party, the people who are the neocons on the defense kind of foreign policy issues, but you're seeing the struggle there because you don't have the perfect candidate. And likewise, I think with the Democrats, there's a huge issue, and I mean, most of the polls show it, a generational divide between sort of the folks living in the memories of, you know, whether it's FDR or JFK or the Clintons, and then younger people who knows how they're going to vote given they all own cell phones and nothing else, who seem to view Obama as the candidate of their generation.
But, Peg, you know this in politics. When push comes to shove, especially in primaries, the older voters will be there.
I think you're absolutely right.
Younger
voters,
weather, who knows?
Weather's
they
gonna
always
matter,
say they'll be there.
And weather's going to matter. But I do think that Obama is the first candidate in a long time to have a certain charisma that has appealed to
I
under 35.
I mean, this is bad for you, Joy. Peg and I are agreeing.
Yeah, well, that's
this is also an election for the Democrats, too. I mean, you're seeing for the first time, certainly living memory, two parties where there's no incumbent, sort of like defining where they're going. Certainly the Republican candidates have very little interest in endorsing George Bush. And so you're going to see something that you haven't seen before, candidates who are redefining what they want to do in parties. I think the Democrats, I don't disagree with anything Peg said about the Republicans, but I think the Democrats are in the same situation. I mean, one of Obama's issues, which I find fascinating, is this, does this country want to go for another 8 years of Bush Clinton kind of leadership? That's a very interesting question that will also be played out in 2008.
Well, and that gets to what I think is a divide in both parties, which is sort of the folks who want to play the insider game where money is power, where much is done behind closed doors and the like, and then there are factions in both parties, actually. I'd argue more so in the Democrats, where it's sort of the, return the government to the people kind of a notion, and not this sort of professional political operative economy and this professional government service economy, which has invaded both parties. And I think that kind of subliminally is a theme throughout this election.
I need to take a break. We will switch to state issues after this break because lots happening in the state of Wisconsin as well, and much of our week in review almost over now. Talking with Peg Lautenschlager, former Democratic Attorney General of Wisconsin, a former state legislator, former U.S. attorney, currently an attorney with the firm Lawton & Cates, and Jim Miller, who is president of the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, if you'd like to join in talking about state issues, issues that were before the state legislature this week. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock, talking with her guests about the International Climate Summit wrapping up in this week. And then after 10, she talks with the author of Put a Little Latin in Your Life. That's Kathleen Dunn between 9 and 11. We are reviewing the news of the week with Jim Miller and Peg Lautenschlager. And to the phones we go. Let's have a caller change the subject for us. Fred in Madison. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Hi. I was calling about the constitutional amendment to limit the Frankenstein veto power.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a tragic mistake on the part of the legislature to pass this, because it does not, it will not prevent governors from stitching together bits and pieces of appropriation bills to make laws the legislature did not approve.
I thought that that's what it was supposed to do.
And it will not do that. It will merely permit the governor to, or prevent him from combining parts of two different sentences to make a new sentence. But he could still rewrite a single sentence to increase spending, create a tax, as has been done in the past, of $234 million. And create other laws the legislature never approved.
Okay, so what are you going to do when this is on the ballot in April, Fred?
Well, I think that's what's tragic about it, because it sets up a choice for the people of this state that however they vote on this amendment, they're voting to confirm a dictatorial power on the part of the governor.
Well, what do you think of this, Peg Lautenschlager? I have to put you back on the air.
Well, Fred's obviously the expert on this, Fred Wade, who's done a number of these cases, is your caller. And hi, Fred.
Mm-hmm.
But, I think it's very sad, because we do have an imbalance. And, and I saw it at a time when I was a majority Democratic Party member in the legislative body, and Governor Thompson was a Republican governor. Now we have at least one house in the legislature controlled by Republicans and a Democratic governor. The thing I always find amazing, it's the biggest flip-flop issue in the state. All of these guys are against it when they're in a legislative body or attorney general or serving in some other capacity, but as soon as they become governor, they want that veto the way it is. And I think it's sad. I think it, again, takes the public input out of things. I don't know how I'm going to vote on this amendment, but it is a conundrum.
Mm-hmm. Jim Miller?
Yeah, I think, first of all, Jim Doyle must be wondering, why is it on my watch? Democrats won the state senate, and that's my reward. I think first of all, should a governor have the ability to change letters or words? I don't even think that that's in the realm of crazy. It's worse than that. I mean, they should not have that power. And I don't care who the governor is. Veto power is the one thing, but to make a yes into a no, that makes absolutely no sense. One of my problems with all this, though, this is an important constitutional change in the state. Why is it going to be on the April ballot when no one really votes? Why is it on the November ballot? But a lot of Wisconsinites will be coming out to vote.
But that gets back to my fundamental premise on all these other issues, too, Jim, which is that, tragically, we have people in government who don't trust citizens to make the right choice.
Yes, and Peg, I have polls coming out this weekend where about 9 to 10% of the residents of this state believe their elected officials act in the best interest of the voters. And this is a case in point. They don't care about voters in the state. It's one of the reasons why confidence in our state government is at an all-time low. People don't believe that their government officials really care about what they think or will act in their best interest. And it's another case in point. You know, why do you put this thing on an April ballot when you have a presidential election in November?
Well, that's something we can think about. One of the things that will be on the
thing about turnout, though, I mean, like, you're going to have four to five times as many people probably voting in November than you will in April. And this is a constitutional change.
And yet, as a nation, we complain when other countries don't have high voter turnout.
Yeah. Well, some of the other things that our state legislature did this week, a floor session on Tuesday, the assembly did pass, or at least gave preliminary approval to a bill that would force hospitals to provide information on emergency contraception to rape victims, and opponents are saying that they're still going to try to fight this. They don't want hospitals to have to do this. Peg Lautenschlager, should hospitals have to do this?
Absolutely. This is a question of a patient's right to get what is basic medical care. This isn't a right-to-life issue. This is a control issue, and who gets to control medical decisions, and it ought to be patients. The reality is most communities in this state and other places have one, maybe two hospitals, and if there is somebody who is a victim of a crime like rape, they have one place where they can go. If you had a if you had a hospital run by people who didn't believe that surgery was appropriate, I don't think that you would have a state which would allow for that hospital not to do surgeries or something like that. The reality is you take people as they come and you give them medical treatment that's appropriate and required. Mm-hmm. And when somebody is a victim of crime and they would like to prevent conception from happening, in terms of an egg that's fertilized being implanted in a woman's womb, I think that's a fundamental decision that goes to victims' rights and goes to an issue of people making their own health decisions.
Jim Miller?
Yeah, on the other side is the role of hospitals run, especially like Catholic hospitals, mm-hmm. where they have a fundamentally different view of what you should do for a rape victim. And do they have a constitutional right to be able to deny some of these procedures? And I think that that's basically what the issue is going to be about in the legislature.
But what essentially they're doing is, if they have that constitutional right, they're not only being able to exercise the right on their own, but they are exercising that right for all of those victims who have as an option only that health care facility. And by their running that health care facility, they are precluding, for the most part, victims from having any other options. So their option becomes the victim's option, and I think that's where the problem lies.
Well, I think, yeah, but there's another fundamental problem, Peg, is that if they firmly believe that what they're doing is immoral against the teachings of their church, you're putting them in a terrible conundrum.
Well, then they ought to not in the hospital business, at least not in a monopolistic sense.
Let me ask you a question. Would you say the same thing if it was a Muslim hospital?
Absolutely.
I mean, whenever we get into the stuff, a Catholic hospital doing X, Y, or Z.
Oh, I agree with it.
They're not allowed to have the same kind of religious beliefs that other institutions in this country are.
No, I agree with it. It shouldn't be in a Muslim hospital. And if if Muslim hospitals have psychologists who, give an opportunity to say one thing or another in terms of how one should act in a particular situation. I think I'd oppose that, too. I mean, at some point, we need to realize that health care is a right.
Healthcare is definitely a right, but so is there a right to have strong religious convictions.
Oh,
what you have
absolutely.
Here is a clash.
But when your religious convictions are imposed on somebody else, I think that's where the problem lies.
Well, I wish we had more time, but I do want to talk a little bit about health care. We had, I think, dueling polls out this week, including one from your organization, Jim Miller, on health care. The Badger poll, I think, showed that a majority of us support state-run health care in Wisconsin. And what did your Wisconsin Policy Research Institute
Well, I think, first of all, let me say something. I mean, the two polls were done roughly at the same time. And I think both sets of polls agreed that the two biggest issues in the state are reforming health care and taxes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Having said that, it's just a question of the questions that were being asked.
Mm-hmm.
We've had some tracking questions going back 17 years, where all of a sudden there's a lot less support for a government-run system than there had been in the past. One of the things that we also asked was this whole question of migration. I'd almost like to ask, if I can, Peg, a question. Well, one of the things that's being talked about in these universal health care plans for Wisconsin is a residency requirement of 12 months. Considering what the Supreme Court said about welfare migration,
yeah.
Do you think that would hold up in the courts, a residency requirement?
I don't know, but I think it's certainly something that would be litigated. I think you're right on that, and it's an interesting
So there's a good chance that you could, if you created a system, you could not guarantee a 12-month residency requirement.
I don't know. I'm not saying there's a good chance. I'm just saying that it's certainly something that would I would guess be looked at some point. What I found most interesting, Jim, on the other hand, is your thing that said, or your statement saying that the two polls weren't necessarily different. It was just how they asked the question.
Well, no, but they're not. We're asking either or questions, and they're asking, you know, would you like this? Would you like that? You know, there's a major difference there.
Oh, I understand that. I'm finding it an interesting admission against interest by a pollster.
Sorry.
Well, let's talk about the other poll that did get a lot of attention that Wisconsin Policy Research Institute issued, and it was that most of us in Wisconsin oppose various benefits for illegal immigrants, right, Jim Miller?
Yeah, I mean, what was interesting in this poll, like if there are some states who have, you know, passed legislation to give benefits to illegal immigrants, like allowing driving licenses or granting in-state tuition. So we asked those questions here. There's overwhelming opposition to it. But we asked the question whether people would support or favor or oppose the idea of sending the children or illegal immigrant children to local public schools. That was roughly 50-50. And we were very careful how we did, Peg, for your information, this question. Because if you're the child of an illegal immigrant and you were born here, you're an American citizen. You are obviously allowed to go to a local public school. So it seemed to be that people had a different view of this and that they're not real interested in giving benefits to adults, but they will certainly consider giving a benefit to a child.
Mm-hmm. Peg Lunchler?
I don't know what there is to add on this. I mean, I think it's... I think tragically the immigration issue has been molded by people who don't accept leadership on the issue or want to make tough decisions or take tough stands, but rather use it as sort of a divisive wedge issue that impacts voters. And I think, you know, we're seeing that continue.
Now, speaking of wedge issues, let's spend the remaining moment on the city of Green Bay, or I should say the city council president, as an individual citizen, he says, erected at his expense a nativity scene on the Green Bay City Hall with the city leader's approval. Freedom from Religion isn't happy about this. Peg, what do you think? Should the Green Bay City Hall have a nativity scene erected there at a, you know, an individual citizen's expense?
You know, I'm kind of in Mary from Madison's camp, just as she's hoping that Congress doesn't spend all its time talking about baseball. I hope that somebody in the Green Bay City Council, where there are issues involving race, where there have been issues involving divisiveness in the community, where there are economic challenges for them to face, issues involving deterioration in particular neighborhoods and the like, I hope that this guy doesn't get too involved in the nativity thing. I mean, you know, put it in your front yard. It's real easy to do.
And we have less than a minute, actually 30 seconds, Jim Miller.
I mean, it's just amazing to me that people even have problems with whether you call it a Christmas tree or a holiday tree.
Mm-hmm.
I think this whole thing has gotten to the point, and I think most Americans would agree with me. It's just crazy. It's Christmas.
Well, happy holidays, Jim Miller.
Same to you, Peg.
Yeah.
All right. Bye. Jim Miller and Peg Lautenschlager are two guests this week for the Week in Review. Jim is the president of the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute. Peg Lautenschlager is an attorney with the law firm Lawton and Cates. Thanks to Keisha Mabra, Leo Duran, and Christina Taylor, who all helped produce this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.